Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. The story goes that the Lenape tribe let the Manhattan Island go for about $24 in the mid-17th century. But the evidence for that is thin at best and certainly doesn't take the Lenape point of view into consideration. Today we're going to hear about an effort to raise awareness of the history of New York tribes from their perspective, starting with an exhibition and a ready-made lesson plan for school kids. We're right back after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A search is underway for unmarked graves at the site of another former residential school in Saskatchewan. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, more than 55 acres of land will be searched using ground-penetrating radar.
The Capel Indian Residential School, run by the Catholic Church, operated from 1884 to the late 1900s. It was one of the last residential schools to close in Canada. The search began this week of 55 acres, and the entire process could take up to 3 years. Michael Starr is the chief of the nearby Star Blanket Cree Nation. He believes some remains will be found.
We are hoping to find our relatives that didn't make it home.
Survivors of the school talked about their experiences during a community roundtable. One talked about a fellow classmate who told him he was taken by priests and put in an underground hidden cell. Many want answers about what happened to children who never returned home. Others want more. Bobby Cameron is the chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations. He says the Canadian government should charge those still alive who perpetrated the crimes at the residential schools.
If I was 90 years old today, an Indian man, and I killed a white boy several decades ago, and it was just found in the year 2021 that I committed this horrific crime, without question, and swiftly, I'd be thrown into jail, and I'd be put away for life and die in there.
The Capel School, 50 miles northeast of Regina, went by several names. It was destroyed and rebuilt more than once by fire. About 150,000 Native children were forced to attend the schools across Canada from the late 1800s to the late 1900s. Thousands were abused and stripped of their language and culture. Many died. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Recently, near Eugene, Oregon, 15 Native American firefighter trainees carried out a prescribed burn. That's a deliberate and controlled fire, often called a cultural burn by Native people, as it follows methods practiced by their ancestors. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the practice is gaining serious attention.
On the Andrew Reasoner Wildlife Preserve, crews use drip torches to ignite 8 acres worth of brush as water engines stand at the ready. 20th century firefighting by federal and state agencies focused on immediate wildfire suppression, not setting fires to reduce slash and vegetation. But early natives set these good fires to prevent larger ones and to rejuvenate certain plants.
For instance, the women that used to pick the huckleberries, which we call ewam, they would burn, you know, every 4 years into the huckleberry stands to bring back more ewam.
Derek Kimball is a Klamath Modoc tribal member with a nonprofit called Mukluxgakini, meaning place of the people. He brought several youth along to share indigenous fire practices, which were suppressed for generations after colonization.
So with the loss of the knowledge through history, that's played a big part in what we're seeing today with the devastation of the mega fires and the dying of the forest.
After more than a century of wildfire suppression, many incidents have been catastrophic in size and intensity. Accumulated slash and vegetation, combined with a hotter and drier climate, have sparked monstrous fires, including this year's Dixie Fire in California. But more and more forestry agencies are exploring controlled burns as a way to limit the size and spread of future wildfires. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull near Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the annual Native Cinema Showcase. 47 films representing 39 Native nations in 13 countries, available from November 12th to the 18th on demand at americanindian.si.edu. COVID-19 vaccinations, now available for everyone 12 and up, are highly protective against the new Delta variant and can protect your children and family from COVID-19. This reminder provided by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health, which supports this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. New York is known for its world-class city, entertainment, trade, and a beautiful natural environment. But I'll bet you didn't know it's also one of the first places where Europeans first encountered the indigenous people who were already living here. An exhibition at the National Museum of the American Indian aims to flesh out what people know about the tribes that called New York home. In addition to the exhibition, there is a lesson for 4th and 5th grade students that was developed over a period of years with the help of Native leaders and educators. We'll hear more about the exhibition and the educational project during this hour. And, as always, we want to hear from you. What were you taught about New York tribes, and does it square with what you now know to be true? Maybe you didn't learn about New York's indigenous people at all. Give us a call. Either way, and join our discussion. Our number is 1-800-996-2848. Once again, that's 1-800-99-NATIVE. And a small disclosure, the National Museum of the American Indian is a financial contributor to Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, Native America Calling's parent company. We have a lot of distinguished guests today, so at this time I'd like to welcome out our first guest. Joining us from Victor, New York, is Peter Jemison. He's the historic site manager at Gunnondagan State Historic Site. He's a member of the Seneca Nation of Indians and a member of the Heron Clan. Nyawiskano, and welcome to Native America Calling today, Pete.
Nyawiskano, Gagwego. Glad to be here with all of you, and good to talk with you, Brett.
It's long overdue to have this important conversation on the miseducation, if you will, of the history of indigenous peoples throughout New York. And you've been at the forefront of this for many decades now. Now, I do want to get a little bit more of a general background here in just a bit. But as I was mentioning, we have a lot to talk about today. So let's hop right into it right now. What was your role in developing this exhibition at the National Museum of the American Indian?
Well, my role was to read over the script, the text that would be used in the different areas of the exhibit, and if I saw anything that I knew was incorrect, needed correction, I offered that information. If I had some ideas that they might use as they were developing the exhibit, I made those suggestions. This has been a very long process. You may be aware of it, but it's been dragging on for a number of years. And so I have had communications with different people that have been involved with the development of the exhibit. I don't think it's exaggerating to say at least for 5 years. And at one point in time, they purchased a piece of my art for the exhibit. I'm not sure that it got included, but this has been a long, ongoing process.
Well, let's follow up with that real quick. This process for this particular exhibit's been going on for about 5 years. How has that process grown, if at all? If you were to go back 5 years and let's talk about your role in that and exactly what it took to get to here now, are you seeing more cooperation, the same level of cooperation, or...
Well, I think what probably happened in the time period that I was involved is that it went beyond the immediate area of New York City and went out to, Western New York in particular. I believe the Tuscarora are a part of this, and also a discussion of the Mohawk people. So So it wasn't simply limited to the people who live in the immediate area of New York City or Long Island and the nations. And, of course, there were many nations there, so there's a lot to cover there. But, the reach is a little bit further out. And I might have wanted to see more, and I think Johanna will help us to recall all that's there, because I haven't seen the finished exhibit. So this will be a revelation for me when I go in December.
You mentioned offering advice and helping to clarify misinformation and things like that. What information have you come across over the years that is just plain wrong about either on the Wakat, the Seneca people, or the Haudenosaunee, or other tribes throughout New York?
Well, I think the big thing, of course, is just an absence of information about us. That, you know, we have school teachers from Western New York to basically what we call Albany in the eastern part of the state, who are required to teach a unit on the Haudenosaunee to fourth graders. And the problem is that they really have no resources to be able to teach that unit unless they are individually motivated to do research themselves and try to find supportive materials and illustrations or whatever you might say, visuals. Unless they have access to that, this unit can be a very shrunken presentation that doesn't get beyond the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, and something like that. I mean, this is important to know that we able to feed ourselves and we're very good agriculturalists. But there is so much more that they simply don't know about. So it's been a lack of information. Ganondagan has given them one thing that was really important, and that is an actual bark longhouse so that they could experience the architectural space that we lived in. And then we can define how was that architectural space used, how were the individual family units set up, and how did the longhouse function? It was really the domain of women, and everything out in the forest, the domain of men. So these kinds of very basic things we're able to relate. But, you know, from building a model, a simple model on a desk, to having an actual longhouse you can walk into is a big change.
I think at times I take it for granted that I grew up on the Allegheny Territory, which for the casual listener out there today, there is a modern city, Salamanca, that is built on the territory. And so the Salamanca City Central School District, even when I was going, was trying to take those steps to incorporate more input from the local leadership. However, I guess, being in this little bit of a bubble here, I wrongly assumed that this was going to have ripples out throughout the rest of New York State. As it seems right now, that's simply an oversimplification. But Pete, before moving on to our next guest, I do have one last question for you that kind of ties all this together. Without indigenous input on history, what kind of misinformation is the public likely to be told?
Well, I really hate to get into this, but, there's this depiction of us as the savages, that we are the people who were, murdering the poor innocent settlers who are coming into our territories, or that we were siding with the British and fighting against the United States. You know, our warriors chose sides, and our warriors were given that freedom to do that. But what we're talking about here are people who are trying to defend their homeland. Our lands become, sort of the subject of the expanding population that landed along the East Coast. They took a look out into central and western New York, and they saw the rich farmland. They saw the best places to grow the food that supported us and the beautiful orchards that provided the apples and the pears and the peaches. Any of those things that they saw growing, were enormous, 15 feet high corn plants with, ears of corn that were over a foot long. All of this stuff, of course, made them realize, that we were living in a land of abundance. And so there was this desire for our land. And so naturally, we have to have a place to live, and we're trying to figure out a way to balance this desire for the settlers to move onto our territory and for us to wind up with land. So we had to go through the treaty making process, and people know nothing about the making of treaties. They know nothing that, for example, the U.S. Constitution says treaties are the supreme law of the land. No awareness of this. And when we're talking about treaties, the original treaties between the United States are made with Native Americans. That's the first people that make these treaties. All of that information is absent in most people's education.
I think something that needs to be addressed is that not only are the treaties the supreme law of the land, but these very same treaties that haven't been honored over the years are the same treaties that the early American government was using to sustain its claims of being an autonomous kind of government like that. Pete, I thank you so much for your insightfulness into this very important topic. Again, another thing that I think that gets missed on people is the amount of misinformation that is out there. The lack of education is exactly what people like Crystal Echo Hawk and the efforts at Illuminatives are trying to counter, this fact that education is key to understanding how we can move forward as a nation like that as well. So we do have a few more guests that we got to get on. It looks at this point, we're going to have to wait until after the break. And I want to put this out to you, the listener, as well. Once again, don't forget, we want to hear from you. We're learning about tribes in New York State, New York City, Manhattan region. We want to hear from you. What have you learned? If you've learned anything, you can be sure to give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. Once again, that's 1-800-99-NATIVE. With that being said, in this next segment, going to be bringing out Curtis Zuniga, co-director of the Lenape Center. I'm also looking forward to speaking with Johanna Goralik, manager of the Education Department at the National Museum of the American Indian. Once again, this is Native America Calling. We'd love to hear from you today. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We'll get your comments on the air. Post the pic on Instagram at Native America Calling. We have to take a short break, but don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this.
Anishinaabe artist Ke Sekola is an iconic figure in the world of indigenous music. On the next Native America Calling, we get a taste of what happens live when he steps to the stage. Here's a sample of what's to come on our November Music Maker. Riders on the storm. Join us for our next hour when we visit with Keith Sekola.
As tribal leaders, we know we need to protect our elders, but it isn't always apparent what harms them. Some of our elders feel socially isolated or lonely. The more we are socially connected with our family and community, the less health problems we will have and the longer we will live. As tribal leaders, we can also create programs to help our elders. Connected together, we'll stand strong. More on elder isolation and caregiver resources at connectedindigenouselders.org. The National Indian Council on Aging supports this show.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Today we're learning about tribes from a specific region of the country today, the indigenous people from New York, their history, their enduring influence, and the contributions they continue to provide. The number to get in on the discussion is 1-800-996-2848. Once again, that's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Now, very briefly, before I do bring our next guest on, it's my understanding we have a caller, Alana, calling from Idaho Falls, listening in on KISU. Welcome to Native America Calling today.
Hello.
Hello, Alana. Welcome.
Thank you. My name's Alana, and I was listening in, and I thought about it because I'm from Philadelphia originally. That I don't think we really were educated about the tribes there in Manhattan or New York growing up. Now, granted, our history books were printed, I think, before I was born, So we had very outdated materials in general, but it seems like we weren't educated at all about the actual tribes and their histories.
And how has this come up throughout your years? Have you encountered, I guess, I don't want to get too deep into it, but any embarrassing moments because of that lack of education?
I wouldn't say embarrassing, but as an individual, I started working with Native American or Indigenous people at a pretty young age. I came into contact with people, so it became more about finding out on my own, first with a Lakota woman I worked with as a teenager, and more recently, I have really good friends here who are Eastern Shoshone in the Wind River Reservation area, and among other folks. So I wouldn't say it was an embarrassment as much as I really wish we had gotten access to more information earlier, and that would have been included in our histories. Considering I lived in a place steeped in the history of the Americas, being in Center City, Philadelphia, I grew up two blocks from the Liberty Bell, so I wish we had had more of it.
Perhaps embarrassing wasn't the right term I was looking for. Maybe awkward moments where some of that information or lack of information you didn't or didn't receive maybe caused a little bit of awkwardness. But I understand exactly what you're saying. And it is my understanding as well that this is a common part of the dialogue right now. And as I was mentioning, Crystal Echo Hawk and Aluma Natives, they have found that the overwhelming majority of people do want to know more. So you're certainly not alone as far as that goes. We certainly appreciate your comments today. At this time, because we do have a few more guests I want to bring on today, I'd like to welcome Curtis Zuniga, joining us from Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Curtis Zuniga is the co-director of the Lenape Center. He's an enrolled member of the Delaware Tribe, and I'd like to welcome you at this time to Native America Calling, Curtis.
Hey, Kulmasima Hashna Mohamo, Wilikishku, Waneshi. Thank you, Brett. It's a good day to be Indigenous.
I certainly appreciate you taking a little bit of time to join our conversation today. So this this exhibition is directly tied with the history of your people, the Lenape. What specifically do you want people to know about the Lenape and Delaware peoples?
Well, let me say quickly that I want your listeners to differentiate that this particular exhibit was curated and presented through the New York City NMAI location as opposed to the Washington, D.C. one, even though on their website and virtually everyone can see it. But indeed, Native New York was first presented to me in the year 2013 by the original curator, Gabrielle Tyack. I had numerous meetings in person, over the phone. She even brought out a couple of colleagues, and we had a town meeting in our community of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, which is the headquarters of one of the five, count them, five groups of Lenape who are federally recognized, two of those being up in Canada, by the way. So we did have interaction early on, as far back as 2013. But as your previous guest, Pete, said, that kind of fell off the radar screen for a while, and that project didn't go very much further until I was contacted in 2018 and came back to New York City and met with some of the staff, including your next guest. And I shared a lot of historical information as a cultural educator that the Lenape people are the original people of that area of New York City and Manhattan. Our original homeland went from like the foothills of the Catskill Mountains up the Hudson River all the way south past Philadelphia and down into the Delaware Bay. So you have two major river valleys, the Hudson and the Delaware, by the way, which included the lands of Philadelphia, as your previous caller mentioned. So I was pleased to be asked to be a part of this educational process. I will say that I am disappointed that a lot of the history of that time was not fully presented. I'm Lenape. I'm a Delaware Indian, so I'm going to want to see a full exhibit on our tribe alone and our history. But I also found out that's not the way it works within the Smithsonian environment. So a lot, as your previous guest Pete said, there's a lot of colonialism, manifest destiny, land theft, massacres of people. A lot of that was kind of glossed over and mentioned, and perhaps some of it might have been put into some of the educational material that you have to go find over on the internet and on the website. As far as the exhibit, though, I think with the emphasis being more on a contemporary presentation through some amazing young artists, you know, that part's nice. But again, I think we glossed over a lot of that manifest destiny story. And I don't know the reasons behind it, but it seems to be a pattern of NMAI ever since they first opened the main museum in 2004. They didn't want to really spend a lot of time on what happened in the past. They spent more on what are we doing today.
It certainly seems like this is a big black eye on the history of this country that I think finally the national discourse is starting to recognize as being a necessary part of the healing. And I would even go as far to say helping to redirect the course of the future of this country as well. Curtis, before moving on to our next guest, you were talking about the Lenape being the original stewards of that land there. I mean, we see that influence all the time, even with the word Manhattan. That's a Lenape word, correct?
That's correct. Or Manahata, as we said. It translates to being the place where they gather the wood to make bows and canoes and the like. So it was an amazing place and an amazing place of commerce and trade. But the stories come out like it was the Europeans that brought trade and commerce to that area and made New York City what it is, where the Lenape had already established as a place of trade and commerce. I think that part of history was kind of glossed over. I mean, we dealt with tribes all the way down into Mexico and Central America and all the way up into Canada along those river routes. So that area of Manahata was an important place of trade and commerce for the native people before the Europeans ever showed up.
That is the common thread throughout the history of colonialism, especially when the history books are continuing to be written on the foundation of a lie. We'll come back to you in just a few, Curtis. At this time, I also want to bring on our next guest. Joining us from New York City is Johanna Gorelick. She's the National Museum of the American Indian Education Department manager. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Johanna.
Thank you, Brett. Nice to be here.
It's certainly appreciated that you could take a little bit of time to join us today. It's my understanding that you helped develop the lesson about Native people from New York. I was wondering if you could give us an example of what a fourth or fifth grade student might learn through this.
I'd be happy to. I mean, I think as both Pete and Curtis mentioned, unfortunately, the curriculum has not changed much for the last 20 or 30 years that I've been here at the museum. There's a real absence of Native presence. There certainly is no Native voice, and there's no Native perspective in the curriculum. It is in the fourth grade, as it has been for, the past couple of decades, and really talks about Native people as the first inhabitants of New York, but not really talking about them as you've discussed with your earlier speakers, as sovereign nations, as people that had, an understanding they were stewards and caretakers of the land. They had, extensive trade networks long before the arrival of Europeans. None of that is brought into the curriculum at all for young learners.
So what are some of the ways that the current lessons are taught that do a disservice to Native people?
Well, I would say the biggest disservice is that most students in elementary school leave those grades thinking of Native people only in the past tense. Very few students are really learning about the legacy of the histories that they're learning. Most of the histories that they are learning are kind of pre-1900. And so they're not aware that Native people are contemporary. They're not aware that the history has kind of continuing impacts on Native people's lives. And they're only relegated mostly to a social studies curriculum. So they're not seeing the vibrancy of Native, you know, Native artistry. They should be reading Native authors in their literature, in their English classes. They should be looking at Native illustrators. They should be looking at amazing works of art from Native people in their art classes. They should be learning about the amazing science and technology inventions and innovations from Native people in their STEM classes. All of these things are really missing from the way that students are learning about Native people today.
Let me ask you, Johanna, and this might be a little bit of a tough question, so I'm not trying to put you too much on the spot. Why do you feel that there is such a hesitancy from the state to get with the game on this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we have to really kind of reconcile our past and understand, kind of see the true stories. I think the narratives that are often put forth, I mean, best case is that they're, you know, partially truth, they're inaccurate. Worst case, they're kind of, you know, myths, just outright myths. But it's kind of filling in the gaps, really starting to think about the more complete narratives of these histories, the different perspectives that we're learning from, and then bring that forward to the present tense, because we can't just leave history in the past and have students think that that was then and this is now. But we have to really have students be critical thinkers and question what those moments in history do for people. Why there is this absence and this mythologizing about these stories. And I think that's hard. The other reason, frankly, is because a lot of people that are writing the curriculum are learning the same facts that all students are learning, so they don't know any differently. But I will say this, that teachers that are coming to our lessons or to our museum or going to places like Ganondagan are eager for the more complete histories, more complete truths. They just don't know where to find it, and they don't know how necessarily to integrate it into their curriculum because the standards are so narrow. So they have to fit it into a very crunched time period. Any of your listeners that are teachers know that their days are really packed with, you know, with things that they have to do. So fitting in anything new or extra is really hard. So, but they're eager to learn. People are very open and willing. They want change.
Well, thank you very much for your contributions to today's discussion. Before our time is up, I'd like to touch on the digital lessons that accompany the exhibition. But I do want to get our final guest on before we have to go back to break. Michael, my apologies, Nyawe, for being so patient with us today. Joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Michael Shiashi. He's an artist and founder and technologist at Alternative Media. Excuse me. Michael is Caddo. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Michael.
Now we welcome Sedentia. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. So I want to try and get a question in before we go back to break. What theme did you arrive at as far as your contributions go, and how did you develop the illustrations for this exhibition?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief, knowing we're about to go to break. But, you know, just like you're hearing from everybody else, you know, the exhibit and everything associated with it, you know, it's built on the backs and ideas of many, many people. So alternative media are in A&M. We worked partnered with Dr. Lee Francis in Native Realities, as well as several artists, including Aragon Starr, Dale DeForest, Weshoyo Albitre, Maria the Wolf Lopez, and others. So really what we brought forth and hoping to do is that brand new sort of, you know, quote unquote, medium of comic books and the presentation of visual media within that. So really what we try to do is inject many of what you're hearing, you know, the continuance, showing the sort of newer technology of the storytelling in comics and the visual milieu.
Well, I do have a few more questions for you, Michael, so thank you very much for, I guess, the expedited, the Reader's Digest version of your contributions to this exhibit. It is so important, and like I said, we'll pick right back up here in just a few. And don't forget, we want to hear from you as well. You're listening to Native America Calling. We want to hear from you today, so call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter as well. So if you have a comment or question, you can also email us. Don't forget, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And we will be right back after this.
COVID-19 vaccine booster shots are available for people at higher risk for COVID-19 who received the Pfizer vaccine and got their second shot at least 6 months ago. If you are 65 years or older, have an underlying condition such as diabetes, or work in healthcare, correctional facilities, or other risky settings, consider getting a third dose for more protection against COVID-19, including the highly contagious Delta variant. This message is brought to you by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health, who support this program.
Thanks for listening today to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. What would be in the school lesson about your tribe that isn't widely taught or known about? We're talking about school lessons using Native perspectives. The number to get in on the discussion is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Now, before going to the first caller, or the second caller, I guess, but the first one of this break, I want to pick back up with the conversation with Michael Chiasi. He's an artist and founder and technologist at Alternative Media. Michael, your illustrations are one of the main ways members of the public are drawn into and interact with this exhibition. But before going into the challenges that you perhaps encountered, how did the National Museum of the American Indian find you?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I kind of forget the comic book joke there, you know, what's the origin story, you know, that. I had served as an intern at the Smithsonian, not the NMAI, but at a different museum years ago, and was approached in 2017 to help do some comic book work because I'm known for a book I published on how we're portrayed Native people in comic books. So I was reached out by some of the staff there on a different project, and then that led to some discussions for the Native New York project as well. So really, it has to do with, you know, being able and working along with many others I just mentioned in the industry, as well as producing information that sort of helps negate some of those stereotypes we've been talking about today.
So moving on to that next question then, what kinds of challenges have you encountered in engaging the public while at the same time portraying the people accurately?
No, I think that's, you know, that's a real concern. And I think you've heard from some of the other members today and the other panelists that it's a real concern in many ways. You know, what is the editorial voice left in, left out? And you know, as far as that, and also what did we, you know, incur as children? I certainly didn't learn about some of these. You know, we had the sort of misinformation of, you know, what was the sale? What was the monetary value of the sale in New York? So overcoming some of those stereotypes was fantastic. And to do it in a visual medium of comic books was also fantastic. But the challenge is, you're right,
sifting through the information, ensuring that any historical information didn't depict us only in history, avoiding that stereotype, making sure that we ask really good questions of all the supportive material that was sent to us, you know, from the good folks at Smithsonian. So it was a challenge. It really was. And as many as you know, if you've edited anything, be it, you know, works of fiction or text or visual, you know that there's, again, a lot that gets on the cutting room floor. So again, a lot of those decisions were made, you know, in conjunction, a lot were made, were held constrained by the objectives of the material. So there's definitely challenges there. And as anyone has ever worked in comics or a visual medium, you know that the sheer, you know, putting these things together and cobbling together various personalities, making sure that you actually deliver and execute is quite a challenge. Any of you that work on any project understand that. So aside from the typical project, you know, woes you would have and you know, pain points, again, making sure that the correct information and the verified information from a native voice in a way portrayed that, you know, doesn't stick us back in history, it was very important to us.
I certainly appreciate your attention to detail, and I could say the same for Pete and Curtis and Johanna today as well. We're going to get right back into the conversation. Right now, I do want to go over to the phones. Listening in North Carolina, listening online is George. Welcome to Native America Calling today, George.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's my understanding you wanted to share a little bit of your own personal history.
Well, it's November, so you get calls if you're a Native person to come into the school and talk about American Indians and, of course, about Thanksgiving. I always find that kind of interesting. So we try to keep our tradition alive. We invite neighbors or friends in for our Thanksgiving. And then after the meal is all over that we provided, then they steal our stuff and go home. That should, I hope, bring a little joke to somebody. In any case, I'm very concerned about what is in the schools. There was a wonderful project done by some teachers in York, Virginia, where they put together a curriculum guide called They Taught You Wrong. And it is really excellent. The problem we have, of course, is that a lot of teachers do not have any education as an undergrad or a master teacher to really know much about American Indian history. For example, the Lenape people, Delaware, they're one of their state area was New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and they have now no land base in any of those places. They were all pushed west out of there. So Pennsylvania, for example, is one of 11 states that has no native population with a land base.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, George. And I do want to pass it back over to Curtis right now, because this is something that is also not understood. The very fact that the tribes, your tribe, Curtis, is in Oklahoma is important. What can you tell us about how these Eastern tribes came to the middle of the country?
This is part of the manifest destiny that I spoke of. The encounters with the Native people, who are viewed as savages, to bring these myths of the purchase of Manhattan. Our people didn't understand the concept of land ownership as the Europeans did. How could you own the waters, the land, and everything that's a part of God's creation? The Creator gave that to us to take care of. We don't sell it, and then you have a title, and you have some money in your hand, and then you walk away. So that whole thing is a myth, but that's been perpetrated on us. And then it contributes to erasure when you say, well, we bought this land. You people go now. That's where Wall Street in New York City came up with. They built a wall around New Amsterdam and later New York to keep the Lenape out of their own land. And today's Wall Street is the street that went along the wall that originally kept the Lenape people out. That's not in the school books. So this is part of overcoming the erasure that we as Native people, the indigenous people, must tell our stories. And while the National Museum of the American Indian may be one venue, I think we need to be out there, as some of the other speakers have said. We need to be working with educators, school curriculum, and it needs to be the voices of many of the indigenous people speaking for ourselves instead of looking at non-Indian institutions speaking for us.
I think you hit the nail on the head with that, Curtis. We want to go to the lines again. Calling in from Wasilla, Alaska. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Donna. Listening in on KNBA.
Good morning. I would like to call to pay a tribute to my wonderful Mohawk friend, Winterson. Winterson taught me a lot about being gentle with people. And she was my dance partner, and we were powwow friends. And I just think that I learned a lot about just the qualities of the Mohawk people from her. And she did a lot of honor in her, in the memories that I have of her, of doing things like creating drawings on a buffalo skin. And there's just a lot of things I remember about her that are so powerful. So they're powerful people, and they'll be remembered forever, you know, for everything that they've done and will continue to do. And the courage that she displayed was one that I really admire in the Mohawk people.
Thank you so much for your beautiful tribute to your friend, Donna. Also joining our conversation today is Steve, listening in on KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Welcome to Native America Calling, Steve.
And thank you for all you do. I just wanted to point out another part of the what needs to be remembered that's often overlooked, and that is there's a huge amount that from the beginning of contact and continue, in fact, even more today on the environment and other issues, that American Indians have contributed to the West that's no longer recognized. It was recognized at the time of the American Revolution, and until Andrew Jackson, that the American was a combination of the European and the Indian. But, you know, they couldn't continue to say that. It went underground, though some of us knew it. And there's a huge amount. And we've written that up, 12 of us, a number of them are Native, in four volumes available on Amazon called Honoring the Circle, Ongoing Learning from American Indians on Politics and Society. And the first two volumes are try to be very comprehensive about what's been learned. Other stuff's been published on this, but we've added to it and tried to draw that in. And the last two are what might more might be learned, how we could do a lot better in the world if contemporary societies functioned according to Native values in politics, economics, or relating with the environment and education, and we're happy to share more if that's wanted.
Thank you very much for your contributions and helping to raise awareness of this incredibly important issue. Pete was touching on this a little bit, how most people still to this day don't realize the Haudenosaunee contributions to the formation of the young American government, this idea of separate but equal and standing together, standing united. There is so much that is still missing from the conversation right now. With that being said, I do want to throw this question back to Pete. Now, Pete, moving forward as a country and taking all of these lessons and all of the hardship that, or going upstream, I guess I could say, that you've been experiencing for a number of decades now, what is your hope moving forward? What do you hope to see come in the wake of this exhibition?
Well, first of all, that people are more informed about the true history, and they're not living with the mythology that Johanna talked about and that, you know, we've experienced, where, you know, rather than tell the true story, it's easier to make up some story that, you know, doesn't have any basis in fact. So I think at least the minimum is that the exhibit is built around the idea of sharing truth and trying to tell the real story, the original story, and that's part of what I would hope would come. come out of this. You know, I want to mention one thing, Brett, that you've kind of given me an opportunity to do. On November the 11th, just a couple days from now, we will be commemorating the Canandaigua Treaty, signed in 1794 between the Six Nations and the United States, intended to form a lasting peace between our people, signed by George Washington, ratified by the Senate in 1795. We continue to hold up our part of that treaty, and the United States so far has not done a great job. The one thing that they consistently do yet is send to us treaty cloths every year to commemorate and mark this treaty's anniversary. But we will be standing on the lawn of the Ontario Courthouse, and we'll be commemorating this treaty and saying this treaty for us is still in place. And one of the terms of that treaty was to provide us with all of Western New York from the Genesee River to Erie, Pennsylvania. May it happen.
I'll be certainly keeping my fingers crossed for that as well. And there is still so much more that has to be done. And you hit on that quite beautifully, Pete, that hopefully in the wake of this, people will continue to have a desire to be educated on the truer history or the complex true history. It's so easy to oversimplify such complex matters as the history of this country. But Johanna, I have one last question for you as well. Earlier, I was mentioning that this exhibition is also accompanied by a digital lesson that accompanies it. I was wondering if you would take a brief second to talk a little bit about this.
Sure. So our lesson aligns with the fourth and fifth grade curriculum, where the way that the curriculum is framed is really about European exploration. And so we really wanted to change the perspective of that and have students learn about Native people that were here prior to these so-called explorers, and about the value systems and that they held as communities. And so our lesson is Early Encounters in Native New York. Did Native people really fill Manhattan? And so we introduce who the people are and their different views of exchange, the different ideas about what land meant. As Curtis mentioned, what kind of goods were traded before Europeans arrived, and what Europeans introduced to this existing flow of trade. And then we conclude actually with the only piece of so-called evidence that talks about this sale of Manhattan, which is this letter by this man named Peter Scoggin. And he was not even in New York. He was somebody who was based in Amsterdam, and he wrote this letter that has served as this documentation about this sale. And so we asked students to really think about what's missing from this story, and whose point of view was who wrote this letter, what is their point of view, what points of view are missing, and what do we know anything about the Native people who are engaged in this trade, and do we know anything about what the trade meant to the Native people? And all of those things are not represented in this letter. So we want students to be very critical of this type of documentation as proving this so-called sale. And so we're asking teachers to get their students to think like historians and to be very, to be critical thinkers.
Thank you very much for your contributions to the conversation today, Johanna. And don't forget, listeners, we still want to hear from you. Even though our time is at about an end today, you can weigh in on the conversation as well, either through our website at NativeAmericaCalling.com. You can email, Twitter, and well, that's officially all the time we have for today. I once again want to thank my guests, Peter Jemison, Curtis Zuniga, Johanna Gorelick, and Michael Shiashi. Tara Gatewood is your host tomorrow, and she'll be bringing the iconic musical guest, the one, the only, Keith Sekola. Take care. I'm Brett Mabee.
Buju, gidin amanji owin da bizane dagwad, gida bindige biagaz jidaba ige siwan nananda wiago yin, kashkidino gizisung ma dagin zod, binish gichimani to gizisung, midas weyashinano gunagazid. Ganoje no kid in a shinabe akwazi wagamigung no waj jigikain daman, mawadishiwain healthcare.gov, gema ganoj 1-800-318-2596. Gaundin agadeg the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.